Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is again AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm net control operator for this Limark Technical Net. The Limark Technical Net has been going on in one form or another for over 43 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we gather in front of our radios to educate each other, inform each other, entertain each other, and have a good time. So once again, thanks to everyone who came by tonight when we try to do this all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you the usual link. Okay, if you need to reach me via email is probably best, if you can't find me on the repeater. This would be either for mailbag questions. Those are questions that normally would be asked during the technical net, but for one reason or another, if you're not within radio distance and can't capture the repeater, you can email me the question, and if it sounds good, we will discuss it. You'll either have the option of listening through an internet established audio stream, or you can seek out the archives. We keep archives of these technical nets and play them at your leisure. Other reasons are if you have a topic for discussion that you would like to present or be part of a presentation, or to just sit back and listen to other people talk. Or if you have a puzzle, we're always looking for TechNet puzzles, things to stimulate conversation and stimulate neurons and such, preferably something that's not able to be answered by simply Googling it. Some of my best TechNet puzzles, if you Googled it, you got the wrong answer. So those are particularly valuable. So if you have that in mind, please share. Or if you want me to poke Paul on the shoulder and have him take a look at some NASA space-related thing, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But again, if you want to contact me, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, I keep a link page. Throughout the week, I cut and paste interesting articles that I think other people might find interesting as well. And I post them on a link page. It's called Roy's Link, and you get there by just typing into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. We also offer a chat room. Lately, it's been kind of quiet, but there have been times where it was rather rowdy, active, and entertaining. So if you want to check out the chat room, the easiest way is to just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you there. We have an audio stream that I mentioned. I originally did it solely for the TechNet, but some people asked me to keep it live the rest of the week. So if you ever want to hear what Glen Oak Repeater is doing and you're not in radio distance for it, you can just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will provide you an audio stream of the Glen Oaks Repeater. And of course, I always like to remind people that MyKC2NJI has a great archive of these technical nets that go as far back as September of 2006. Let me drop for a sec. I just don't want to time out the poor repeater. So if you type in amateurradio.tv, you get to Mike's archive. He's had over a million visitors, so make it a million and one. That's the idea. That's the link. As per usual, we will be requesting people to submit questions of a technical nature. Preferably, the first few questions should be amateur radio related, because this is an amateur radio technical net. But as always, we certainly invite any discussion of science and technology, and we'll try our best to address it. That should take us to about 10:15. Paul WS2N will then do the SpaceNet report. That should take us to about 11 o'clock p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well. So that's the game plan. If the laws of physics continue to work the way they're supposed to, and my shack and the repeater work likewise. So with that in mind, if anyone has any questions or topic for discussion or comments, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
W2BZ, non-ham radio.
W2BZ, non-ham radio. I wonder if you were able to look at the University of Exeter article that I sent you about synthetic magnetic fields.
Okay, Rich and Wes recognize. Yes, Wes, I read it. I have my usual kibitzing complaints about the terminology. Physicists do not generally have a good conception of naming things. And in this case, I think the way that they describe the nature of the metamaterial is deeply problematic to me personally, but, you know, this is the same group of people that confuse everyone by telling people that there's a quantum spin and making them think that it's basically a marble that's spinning, or it's the way a planet does. But we'll get to that later, Wes. So Rich and Wes recognize. Anyone else out there want to put their name down? Please do.
WB2BXO with some comments.
Okay, Frank, I would assume that these are amateur radio-related comments?
Nah, I just want to rant about politics. No, well, amateur radio or technet-related,
good. Okay, so we're going to try and do the amateur radio-related things first, and the ones that are listed as non-amateur radio a second, but still, if there's anyone out there that would like to put their name up, especially if you got some amateur radio-related questions, because we're always looking for those, and they're few and far between for some odd reason. But nevertheless, anyone with any questions or comments for tonight, please hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your phone number.
82ALC Ivan, amateur radio-related question.
Okay, Ivan recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight before we get started? Okay, hopefully later on more people will come, more questions, more comments. We'll see what happens. So, we'll be taking the amateur radio-related subject first. Frank, that puts you in the number one position for tonight. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
Yeah, I just kind of did a double take when you mentioned that the technet's been on here in some form or other for 43 years, because I was on here for one of the first, if not the first, technet 43 years ago, and I was using a KDK, I think it was a KDK 144X something or other radio, that I bought from some guy named Alan, M2KW, if I remember correctly. Go ahead.
Ah, very good. So if I have any kind of historic questions, I guess you're one of the guys I should talk to. Unfortunately, I'm relatively new to the hobby. I didn't know about this until about 12 years ago.
Yeah, I probably wasn't on the net for a couple of years, either. I think I am from my location in Brighton Beach. I had trouble hitting the repeater. I think I occasionally got on by taking a walk out on the boardwalk. Then when the net came on EchoLink, I started getting back on again. But unfortunately, the original net controls are silent keys now, which always makes me very sad. Go ahead.
Well, it's my understanding there were two people. There was Vic, who, of course, became a silent key a few years ago. But I think the other gentleman is still living in Queens. I think I looked up his call sign on QRZ, and as far as I'm aware, he's still kicking.
Yeah, we're thinking of the same person. I think he ran into some problems a couple of years, maybe 15 years ago or so. And as a result, I'm not sure if he's still licensed, but you may be right. He may still be around. And of course, sadly, Mel is not around anymore either. Yeah, it was kind of fun at the... I'm sure you've heard stories of the KCRC field days where Dick would come down and sit with Mel and a bunch of us and BS all night long.
Yes, indeed. I've been told those stories, and you know, of all my series of ham radio related regrets was that I joined the Kings County Radio Club in about a month or so before Mel passed on. He was too sick to come to the meeting, but he was a legend there, and so I never got to meet him. I've listened to archived copies of Technical Net where he did his presentation, and matter of fact, he mentioned an old mathematics book for electrical technology that I found a used copy of and bought for myself. And so I never got to meet Mel, and in another way, strangely, although I considered Dick a good friend, I talked to him on the phone, I talked to him on the radio, I never had an opportunity to meet him either in real life. So those are my little amateur radio regrets.
Yeah, he was quite an accomplished guy. Too bad you didn't get to meet him. Very interesting guy. Lots of good stories, some of which you heard on the TechNet. Anyway, let me, enough of the old lang syne. Now let me let you get on to some real questions. I'll be listening, probably chime back in for SpaceNet, UB2DXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thanks, as always, for participating. Ivan, you're next up. What's your question or your comment for tonight?
AE2ALP, Ivan. Well, I kind of have a question about the 220 band. About over the course of 9 months of me being a ham, this is my favorite band, but... I love its propagation, especially when it comes to urban environments, quiet and everything else, but low noise. But I don't understand what's the reason behind of this band being so quiet, and it seems like there is a lack of activity compared to 2 meters and 70 centimeter bands. And even the modern VHF and UHF radios are not, you know, do not include, for the most part, this band as a to transmit on. Just curious, why that is?
AC2GS. Well, I guess that's more of a psychological question than a technical question. For whatever reason, there's a few bands available above HF. Obviously, VHF, UHF. 220, 900 megahertz, 1.2 gigahertz. So there's a bunch of them, and at one time or another, there are people who have put up repeaters on all those bands. I think, unfortunately, it's sort of the same problem to a lesser extent that I see in UHF and VHF, in that repeaters operating on these frequencies is not a very popular thing as it once was. In the old days, repeaters had a ace up its sleeve with auto patches, so that before the age of cell phones, you could show your friends that you could get on either a handy talkie or a mobile, and you'd be patched through your repeater to the telephone line, and you could talk to loved ones and associates as long as you didn't carry on business. When cell phones came into existence, auto patches faded rather quickly, and to this day, new hams, one of the first questions that they ask me is, what the hell's going on with UHF, VHF? They're trying to pick up an active band, and they rarely hear anything. Even the most active of repeaters are maybe active 30% of the time, if you're lucky. So I think it's a problem that there's a limited number of amateur radio operators that are active in the non-HF band, and there's more of a demand. It's a chicken and the egg type of a thing. There's a greater demand for UHF VHF than for 220 or 900 or 1.2 gigahertz. So manufacturers try and figure out how to cut corners and save money. The additional premium for an additional 220 band capability to turn a dual band to a tri-band radio probably they feel is not going to get enough sales to make it a profitable venture. So you got to kind of search around to find devices that are capable of things like 220. And so, you know, with the fact that a lot of transceivers and such don't have that band, it even increases the tendency of people shunning it. And, you know, I mean, unfortunately, on a bad day, you could go to a wide band. Let me drop for a sec. You can go to a relatively wide band like UHF, and with the exception of maybe five DMR stations broadcasting all English talk group, it's relatively quiet. The non-HF bands are not quite what they once were, and the first things that are going to be affected are the kind of secondary bands like 220. At least that's my gist. Now, if there's anyone out there with more experience of working and not working on 220 who'd like to share their experiences, please feel free.
B2BXL. That is actually a historical question to a point. Go ahead.
Well, ultimately, a lot of things end up being historical. If a hobby is more than 10 years, would you like to kind of give us your interpretation of why 220 seems to have been relegated to be the redheaded stepchild of the band?
There are two reasons. One is legal, one is sort of business-related. Business-related, and I guess it's really a sort of legal-related reason also, is it's not an international band, as I understand it. It's not available in most of the world. So it is not really profitable for the manufacturers to manufacture radios for it because they can't sell them worldwide. Pardon the beeps from the microwave there. The second reason is that those of us who have been around since the 80s, I don't know whether it was the 80s or the 90s, remember when the lower, the 220 band is actually a 222 megahertz band now, because I believe it was UPS that pulled all kinds of shenanigans to petition the FCC to give them the lower 2 megahertz of 220. They used some questionable lobbying techniques that were probably illegal, but they got away with it. And they got the lower 2 megahertz, and then if I remember correctly, never actually used them, because by then we started getting into the more modern IP-related technologies on microwave and satellites and stuff to track trucks, and they didn't need it. So that was the other reason why, in my understanding, why 220 is not very active. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, those are good reasons. I mean, you got to also keep in mind that there's a kind of inverse relationship with 4 meters. If you go to Europe, there are specifically 2 models of radios that are very often sold. You'll sometimes even see it designated as the model number dash A for the United States, A for America, and dash E for Europe. Usually the differentiating thing is the European models are able to operate 4-meter band. So you would sort of think the same would be true of the 4-meter band. That's true. I've never really investigated how active the 4-meter band is in Europe, but, you know, it's sort of I don't know if it would be that much more difficult to have an A-designated receiver that instead of enabling the 4-meter band would enable the 220. I tend to think that, at least in Europe, the 4-meter band is used significantly more than, say, 220 is here. And, you know, so like I said earlier, unfortunately, as far as I'm concerned, VHF isn't really used that much. You know, I used to open up my Flex 6700 fan adapter, and I looked over the entire band of VHF, and very often I questioned whether my antenna was connected, because there was not much going on anyplace. So, I don't know, I think it's a combination of things, but I thank you for adding that to the rationale of what's going on.
Yeah, very good. Anyway, I'm going to on the side, as they say, for a while. Jump back in here a bit later. 73 for now. WB2BX.
Okay, very good, Frank. Anyone else want to help me and Ivan kind of figure out the psychology of what's going on, of why 220 is a redheaded stepchild? Please feel free.
WA2ZDH.
W2BC.
Yes, John and Rich recognize. We'll take John first.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact, as you say, it is not used overseas. I do remember when 220, as you say, was cut down, the lower 2 megahertz was taken away, and maybe the manufacturers thought that there would be further reduction on it. It's interesting, though, about 4 meters, around 75 megahertz, I think is 4 meters. That used to be used for paging activity, but I just took a tune across those frequencies now, and I don't see anything there at all. I know there used to be pagers there. And long, long time ago, there used to be, fan markers there for aviation. They used to transmit a heat, I think, for fan markers at 75 megahertz. But I don't think there's much there at all now. That's between channels 4 and 5, I think. Go ahead.
Okay, that's interesting. But I would assume that propagation would be very similar to a VHF, and so it would be line of sight, and since no one in the United States legitimately, at least no amateur in the United States, is licensed to use it, if there is activity, it's probably in Europe, and you probably need to be relatively close to Europe to hear it under those circumstances, but that's all conjecture on my part. Rich, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Unless I'm mistaken, it's my understanding that 220 never really took off when it was introduced. I mean, in the beginning, people got, and the manufacturers came out with tri-band radios, but it always seemed like it was, you know, the third cousin to 2 meters and 440. Was it ever really used? Was it ever really popular?
I do not believe so. As I mentioned earlier, I'm sure there were attempts. People will put up a repeater on any band that they're able to. But I think it was kind of diminishing returns. I would imagine this was, by that time, auto patching and such had already started to fade. And as you said, I don't think it ever took off. Again, I don't know if really the general activity of amateur radio operators can actually require UHF and VHF both together. I mean, you can shove most of the VHF operations onto the empty spaces of UHF and still have a lot of empty space left to fill. So I think it's just that the powers that be got comfortable with dual-band antennas and dual-band transceivers, And most people nowadays have a UHF, VHF antenna receiver, and they bounce back and forth and consider it similar. I don't know if propagation and characteristics of 220 are that dissimilar between a UHF and VHF to kind of warrant anyone to aggressively seek it out. And so, unfortunately, it never really had a chance to blossom, at least as far as I was aware.
For all intents and purposes, 440 and 2 meters are basically dead. We're, you know, Limark is probably responsible for 50% of the traffic on 2 meters in the New York metropolitan area. So, I mean, maybe there are guys who hang out on 220 for some reason, but like you said, if propagation is basically what 2 meters is, I don't see, since 440 and 2 meters is underpopulated as it is, who in their right mind would go to 220 where there's absolutely, you know, not absolutely, but very, 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 very small amount of traffic and try to have a good time. It doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. I mean, unless you have a scheduled conversation with someone that you know, and you're used to kind of landing on someplace in 220 at a certain time of the day and chat with people. I don't see the point myself. I mean, to a degree, you have slightly less chance of people jamming, although thankfully that's not a major problem. And if ultimately you're looking for privacy, you're probably better off using a phone. So, although, you know, there are people who tinker around with every band available. We've had people talk about the 1.2 gigahertz repeater had been down for many years and needed to be repaired. And I think Andy's, one of his last things was putting it back together. You know, unfortunately, the demand isn't really there. People do have radios capable of them, but they're not the most popular price competitive models, but they're out there. So if you're interested, it's still open. And, you know, there's the old adage that if you don't use it, you lose it with the FCC. So it's always wise to utilize the frequency allocations that we've been given, lest we have it taken away. But, again, 200, you know, 220 is a perfectly fine band, but you know, it's somewhat more important how many people actually utilize it that makes the difference between something worth the effort and not particularly worth the effort.
And to VA
WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, you doubled with someone else. He was first, so we'll go to him first, and then we'll go to you, Paul.
Hey, that's from VHG Mobile in South Dakota. Just wanted to say, check me in as a listener. Back to next trip.
Okay, very good, Ken. You are so noted as a listener tonight. Paul, you wanted to say something on the subject?
Yeah, when I started out in, mid-80s, I joined the Suffolk County Radio Club. They were closest to me at the time. And, yeah, they had a 2-meter repeater. It wasn't all that good. It wasn't high up, you know. You know, it was okay. But, you know, if you wanted to drive a long distance on the expressway, you know, at the time, you know, it wasn't that easy. So I thought they were going to, you know, invest more, in doing something with their 2-meter system. But 220 was becoming a big thing at the time. And, you know, there was no talk of, you know, getting back on frequencies like what eventually happened with the 220 band. So, you know, that was going to be, you know, the next best thing. So they poured money into a you know, brand new repeater system, antennas, everything for 220. Meanwhile, I had already gone out and got a, you know, got a 2 meter HT, you know, starting out. I thought, no, now I'm gonna have to buy this, but I never did. I just stuck with the 2 meters. But yeah, you know, and even today they still have it. They have a repeater on, you know, 224.680. So you know, it's still operable, and they use the one. They use a 103.5 TL tone, but I don't know how active it is. They have a primary 2 meter repeater, you know, that's also, of course, active nowadays. Back to you, Roy. WS21.
Okay, Paul. I'm curious, what was kind of causing the need for another band and the interest in going to it. Were UHF and VHF relatively saturated? Were auto patches still a very, very important part of the hobby?
The companies, you know, Kenwood and, you know, Yaesu, they were starting to really put out 220 equipment. You know, before that, there wasn't all that on that much on the market. But they were going nuts, you know. If you look at the earlier QST books, in, you know, from that time, there were all kinds of 220 HDs and things that were available. And I think that was part of it. You know, that was becoming the next best thing. You know, mid-1980s. Back to you.
HHU.
Yes, HHU.
I think one of the big incentives that I remember when I got licensed in 1989 was that novice class licensees at the time were, it was like this incentive licensing deal where novices could talk. The one thing they got was the 28.3, 28.5 portion of 10. You could talk, and then also you could talk on the VHF and UHF. One of them was 220, and that was kind of the time frame maybe that was involved to try to market to those people. You get a novice ticket at the time and talk. So that was kind of maybe. Honestly, when I got it, I went to 2 meters, tech lights, bother, but maybe that was part of the deal, the timing of that.
Okay, that's a good additional bit of knowledge. It sort of sounds to me like it was a bunch of manufacturers trying to crank out an additional profit by offering something new and shiny. It doesn't sound as though it was incredibly well thought out. It was just kind of like, gee, profits are low this year. Let's all get on this 220 and promote it, and maybe we could sell these guys a whole bunch of new radios to kind of add to their collection. But, you know, sometimes these things work, sometimes they don't. You know, we've kind of seen it in more modern times with digital technology where Yaesu decided to promote fusion technology by practically giving away fusion repeaters, and ICOM was very aggressive with their D-Star technology, and not that the manufacturers promoted DMR that much, but because Motorola had so many used repeaters that had DMR out there, it became cost effective. So, you know, sometimes it's just good old capitalism in action, I guess.
A VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Yeah, I think something, one thing that had to do with it, I think, might have been the availability of some surplus equipment. I know back in the early days back in the 70s, that there were some people who were getting interested in tubas via SCR 522 surplus business that covered 100 to 156 megs. That was, some people were converting that for use of 2 meters. But I do want to note one interesting point. I see ICOM has this new rig, the IC905, which is dedicated to VHF, UHF, and even up to optional 10 gig. So that might help spawn some interest in these higher bands. I note that I remember Dick always used to say only one in so many people is an amateur radio operator in the neighborhood, and then out of the amateur radio operators, only one in so many are interested in the UHF or microwave bands. So I guess it's just the lure of the of HF and the distance. Personally, I like a good conversation on the VHF band. Anyway, back to that.
AC2CR. So thank you, John. Yeah, I'm familiar with the newest ICOM. I remember they initially presented it as a technology demonstration. I think only when they received relatively active feedback from customers that they might be interested in investing in the additional 10 megahertz module, that they actually turned it into a real product to be bought and sold. I don't know how popular microwave ultimately is. I mean, Dick, may rest in peace, was one of those big guys in the field. He built linear amplifiers. He built all kinds of things for microwave. He was part of a website that collected articles on the subject. He wrote many of them. And I think it's a very smart, small group of inventors and such. Back in the old days, you couldn't buy anything commercially. So if you couldn't make it yourself or find a friend to make it for you, you weren't in this particular aspect of the hobby. Then down in Florida, a company started to manufacture UHF, VHF, and microwave converters and such. And now ICOM has gotten into the business. But, you know, they're all kind of a point-to-point contacts. Every so often, a couple of guys go up to a mountain, two different mountains, and point their transceivers at each other and try and break the record for longest microwave distance contact. I still think it's kind of a pioneer concept. I don't think the average guy sitting in his shack is going to really get the most out of microwave technology, because, you know, the point-to-point necessity and the free space loss issues with it. But it was interesting to see that ICOM decided to try and make a profit off of it. Unfortunately, I'm never going to find out if they made a profit. I guess if they bring out other models or if they keep this model in production, it will be a good indicator. But for the most part, it's very difficult to figure out how well a model is doing unless you come into contact with people who are using it. So far, I haven't heard anyone who is particularly looking forward to go into the microwave band.
N2VHG Mobile, those comments.
Sure, Cam.
Yeah, hi, from South Dakota. I'm just headed south out of Rapid City, doing some weekly food shopping out here. A point of interest, it was 102 degrees today. Nice and crispy, sunny. 220 is only used, I think, in our ITU region. When I lived over in Europe, 220 was forbidden. So it's a very small market, I also believe. It's very unusual to use 220 around the world. Only Americans, I believe. I'm not sure if it's used in Asia. So I know it's not used in Europe, that's for sure. So it's not a big market, I don't believe, with manufacturers. And limited power also, I believe, when the novices could use it back in the day. It was the novice, like the gentleman was saying before, it was the novice's gateway to VHF. So it was very limited also within our ITU region. And that's my comment from South Dakota, back to that control.
Okay, thank you, Ken, for that. I understand and I appreciate that it's a kind of a locally accessible band, but the economics, you know, if it was only that, I don't think the manufacturers would be that concerned. I think these days the American amateur radio population is the biggest one in the world and the only one that over the last 10 years has actually grown. Unfortunately, if you take a look at Japan and Germany and England, the number of licensed amateur radio operators have shrunk. Right now, last time I looked, approximately there's 750,000 licensed American hams. Most of them are technicians classes, but technicians classes could use 220. So I'm sure if the manufacturers thought that there was any interest, which I don't think there is, they would promote it and try to profit from it, even if it was limited to the United States. You know, we're still a big customer, you know. It's not like, you know, there's India and China is the two most populous countries in the world. But, you know, their percentage of amateur radio operators is probably less than the amateur radio operators in Rhode Island.
WB2BS, so with some more comments.
Yes, Brad.
Yeah, you did bring back some memories. I completely forgot about the 220 being accessible to novices, and I did buy one of my best friends at the time, who's now a silent key, KA2PJN, Jack, was a novice and stayed a novice for the rest of his life. So he only had 220, so I bought 220HT so I could talk to him when he was in New York, and I would be able to talk to him when I visited where he lived, Rochester, New York, home of RARA, Rochester Amateur Radio Association. The novices were, that was an attempt to generate some activity up there, and I don't really know how successful it was, considering that UPS used their marketing power to drop off the lower 2 megahertz into the band and then not use it for gas.
Well, I guess using 20/20 hindsight, it wasn't that successful. Again, unfortunately, I kind of am sad whenever I look at a pan adapter of UHF and VHF and always remember how I had assumed that it was going to be a much more active thing in the metropolitan area, which it decidedly ain't. I guess it's just a case of extra bands cost more money, and they don't really, unless, again, you have scheduled contacts with people who are already on 220, there's not much of a reason for anyone to check out 220 anymore. Again, you know, you could kind of use the same logic for 900 megahertz and for 1.2 gigahertz. There's a lot of other little bits and pieces of bandwidth that people could go to, but because there's so little demand to begin with, it doesn't really produce any further demand. So chicken and egg in action.
Yeah, well, it was an interesting situation anyway. Really haven't thought about the band in years. But, I completely forgotten that I actually was on 220 a couple of times years ago. And I forget, I think I eventually tossed the radio. It was an ICOM. I think it was a 3AT. I really sound like an old-timer now, don't I? Anyway, WB2BX, so go ahead with the next.
Sounds fine to me. John, KD2BD, who listens to the stream and hangs out in the chat room, and a couple of months ago, propagation was a little bit better, so he actually was on the repeater, but he's in the chat room, and he types up a little something. He said 220 was, and maybe still is, a useful band for FM repeater control links and linking a remote repeater receivers and transmitters and perhaps packet radio network backhaul. There are no satellites on 220 for 6-meter or 6 meters for that matter. So I was not aware. I mean, I knew that you could use 220 as a link and a remote control. Most of the repeaters that I had access to tended to use UHF or 900 megahertz as a link. I don't offhand remember any that were using 220 at the time that I was aware of them. But yeah, that's another thing. But you know, again, that's the redheaded stepchild. I mean, using a frequency to control a repeater as opposed to using it as a means to make contacts back and forth, it's kind of a second-class citizen situation, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, it's still not a bad idea to have links on amateur frequencies. I mean, these days, in some cases, it's probably easier to do that with an IP connection, an internet connection, rather than over the air. But then if you're going to use the repeater for emergency communications when the internet is down, that's not all that useful. I think 900 megahertz is also used for that. At one time, I think there was some frequency for. I think there are some links on below 440 also. In the maybe not. I don't remember. But and yeah, the amateur satellites. Yeah, 220 isn't an international band, so that's not used for satellites. And the allocations vary on 6 meters. In fact, I just saw today or yesterday, if you listen to Amateur Radio Newsline, they said the Australians are going to get 50 to 52 megahertz and be able to go down to the low end of 6 meters, where our weak signal work is, which may be interesting at the sunspot peak. Anyway, and they're getting that in exchange for lopping off part of the microwave bands to give to commercial interests down there. But I think we forget that the amateur satellite service actually has get separate allocations, even though they're all within the amateur bands, and most of us are licensed to use both. I think the amateur, so-called amateur satellite service doesn't allow 6 meters and 220, essentially for the reasons I just outlined. So I think that's why you don't have the satellites on there. Go ahead.
Okay. If I was a betting man, which I certainly am not, I would assume that a lot of repeaters might have started off with RF links, but over the years, even though I would make them less bulletproof, that they've shifted to internet providers for voice over IP protocol links. They tend to be more dependable, more durable, less expensive, at least from what I see. Again, it would be nice to see numbers, but I think most repeater net control operators kind of keep those bits of information close to the vest for fear that people are going to do nasty things to gain access to their repeaters.
Yeah, I would think so, even though it's easy enough to look up. I know even the satellites, I know the ARRL, the satellite community, tries to kind of keep the uplink frequencies for the school contacts close to the vest so that people don't jump in to try to get their random FM contacts from the satellite. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we live in paranoid days. More than a few times here on the technical net, people brought up the subject of these devices hooked up to our utilities kind of send signals back to the company so that they can bill you. Gone are the days where you get the doorbell rung and the guy was came to read your meter. And all that information is basically obscured because of security concerns and such. So we all are just sitting around guessing at things, and nothing is really published out there because of that. So it's a common problem in our paranoid days here.
Yeah, I mean, if you really want these frequencies, you can find them. I'm sure it's not that difficult.
Well, I don't know. I've never really looked that deeply into it. I mean, there are always ways of finding stuff out, but, you know, as the levels of security increase, it becomes a bigger and bigger pain in the backside to accomplish it. So, you know, I mean, there are things out there that are readily available. There are things that hushed individuals pass between each other. This morning on this week's episode of the Kings County Radio Club 10 MeterNet, I was kind of talking about blue boxes once again and phone freaks and discovering the dual tones that you had to build into blue boxes to make them work. It was published in manuals that the manufacturers, Ma Bell wrote for themselves, and that other people pulled out of garbage cans and photocopied and such. So, yeah, some of that stuff, ultimately, if you dig deep enough, it's amazing what kind of stuff you can pick up about people and facts and figures and such if you're an aggressive Googler.
Comment, please.
Sure, Ken.
I'm going to be falling off or driving off the edge of the earth, so I want to say 7-3. I'll be out of contact in about a minute. So thank you for the entertainment. I appreciate it. Riding along with me, and I'll say 7-3. So the next time I talk to you, this is N2PHD back to that control.
Okay, very good, Ken. It's always a pleasure, and hopefully you'll be able to join us next week when we do this all over again. Have a safe trip. Be well, and we'll talk to you down the line.
Okay, thank you very much. 73s, everybody. Going back into the Indian Reservation, Old Pine Ridge. Bye-bye. N2PHD, Mobile app.
I guess Ken has one of those old maps that show the edge of the earth with the legend, "Here be dragons." yeah, I guess I'm on with a conversation on 10 MeterNet, I guess, that was triggered by the death of the original blue box guy, Kevin Mitnick. I forget what his call was, I guess.
No, it wasn't. I mean, I knew of Kevin Mitnick. He was basically a general hacker. Usually, if you mention blue boxes, the first name that anyone mentions is, at least in my experience, was Captain Crunch.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yes, Mitnick just died, and that was just in the news, and he had his call letter. But I found that N6NHG it was, N6NHG. And I looked it up. It looked like he stayed a general. That's as far as he went. Back to you.
Oh, okay. It's kind of a shame. My understanding is he passed away. He was 58 years old, far too young, but what can you do? But, yeah, he was a sort of a black hat hacker. And then he traded it in and became a white hat hacker. He certainly had a long history in the field. I used to enjoy reading stories of people who were hackers. I guess I got there with phone freaking because that was kind of, I think, before most personal computers before the Altair 8800s, and I remember my interest, I got my interest from an article in my local library. I used to read, actually, I think on 10 Meters we were talking about the death of magazines and how I would try and subscribe to magazines and read, and I always loved magazines, and I read an Esquire in my public library that had the basic story about phone phreaking, and I discovered it, and I looked up my popular electronic magazines and read about phase lock loop circuits that you could use to build stable two-tone generators, and somehow found out that the radio engineer for WMCA would trade me the two-tone frequencies for the schematic for the phase lock loop. And that was kind of my first foray into those sort of things. Never got around to building the two-tone generator. It was always kind of theoretical with me, unfortunately.
BDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Kevin Mitnick was more known for his red boxing. I know that's one of the things he got in deep trouble with. Well, a red box is what generates the coin tones on a phone. If you put a nickel, dime, or quarter in, you hear these bursts of tones. It's not 2600. I think it's 2200. But anyway, he got in trouble for modifying, changing the quartz crystal in one of these tone generators to produce coin tones, and that got him in the start of getting into deep stuff.
Oh, okay. Thanks for that information. Yeah, in addition to the blue box of phone phreaking in general, there was the red box. There was something also called the black box.
Yeah, black box essentially prevented continuity. So it looked like you were talking onto an on-hook line. It looked like the line stayed on hook. It would pass audio, but it wouldn't pass the DC to acknowledge going off hook.
Ah, okay, that's good. We talked about this about 3, 4, 5 months ago. Someone mentioned a book based, I think, on the Esquire story. That actually I have in my library, but totally forgot that I had, and it's interesting reading. If you're curious about people who try to kind of bend the rules and kind of turn the technology around, it's an interesting read.
BDH with a comment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I'm going to have to rub a couple of people's faces in it at my department because one of the things SUNY Farmingdale has done is to use Mythic Security Agency to help with their security testing and to make people more aware of computer fraud and things like that. So it was his security agency that my department actually used for security testing. Go ahead.
Well, I don't think there's anything particularly bad with that. I mean, he like I said before, he might have started as a so-called black hat hacker. He changed sides. He became a white hat hacker. I assume he made a good living for himself and used his skills the way it's best to be used for the benefit of people instead of just tricking, gaming the system for the sake of gaming the system.
Oh, no, actually, in that sense, he had firsthand knowledge of it, and as such, that was probably a very well-engineered company that he put together in for testing the security of systems.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times you'll find out that some of the most successful designers and manufacturers of protective software kind of started as teenagers breaking things. And they learned a lot of lessons. You know, you could go on and be malicious for the rest of your life. It's a bit of an antisocial way of spending your life. Or you can turn it around and make it into a useful and profitable business. So he's one of the many. There's a lot of white hat hackers out there. They have a convention every year, I think, in Las Vegas, where if you're at all paranoid, you probably shouldn't go anywhere near there, because they tend to kind of show off their abilities by hacking into each other's system. And, you know, these are where you tend to read the public relations blurbs.